Hello and welcome to MK Crypto Diaries episode 3. I am your host, Dr. Justine Sherry Herrera, and today is the 14th November 2022. In today's episode, we'll be talking about all things NFTs. Just last week, Instagram said that it will start allowing a group of digital creators to mint and sell NFTs directly from the social media platform. It will allow creators to make their own digital collectibles and sell them both on and off Instagram. It will be launching on Polygon blockchain. It will allow connections to third-party wallets like Trust Wallet and MetaMask, and it also appears that NFT creators will be able to choose their royalty percentage, which will range from 35 to 40%. But what happens if there is an NFT dispute or a hack? Who will have jurisdiction? Are consumers covered by traditional laws? Does MiCAR, the new cryptocurrency regulation, regulate NFTs? Now, to dive into this discussion, we have here with us Ioannis Revolditis. Now, Ioannis is a true academic. He is currently a lecturer at the University of Malta for the Center of DLT, Distributed Ledger Technology, in Technology Law. His main areas of focus right now include IP, copyright, property rights, NFTs, the metaverse, and private international law. His past experience includes lecturing at many reputable universities, such as in Germany, in Cyprus, and in Greece, and his academic background includes obtaining an LLB, an LLM, and a PhD, all graduated with a cum laude, very impressive. Today, we have the pleasure of hosting Ioannis live from our MK FinTech offices here in Malta. Ioannis, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Justin, nice to see you and thank you very much for the kind invitation.
I look forward to this discussion. So let's dive right in, a lot to discuss. So first question, can you please, for the benefit of our listener, break down in lay terms and give a definition of an NFT, and perhaps also mention some popular use cases, and also maybe if you can go a step further and explain how NFTs differ from crypto, that might also be interesting.
Yes, thank you, Justine. Although this is a rather ambitious question, first and foremost, because there are many ways to define NFTs, most predominantly technical ways, and I have to admit that this is where I meet my limit, because I wouldn't like to risk any technical definition, I mean in terms of course, information technology. But for the sake of the discussion, I can tell you how I understand NFTs, and that comes probably with the benefit that will help the average listener to follow us, because I consider myself to be an average blockchain user. Therefore, I think that I will keep everything within the range of approachable. Now, when it comes to non-fungible tokens, I would like to split them in two parts. There is the non-fungible aspect and there is the token aspect. And in order to start understanding what it is, I would like to first start by the token aspect. What is a token? Well, in common language, token has, of course, several uses. But within the blockchain ecosystem, a token is what I would call a digital native, right? It is some form of a digital representation. In the case of non-fungible tokens, a token represents usually rights and obligations. Now, why non-fungible, since I've talked about the token part? Now, the characteristic non-fungible was created in order to distinguish this kind of tokens from tokens, of course, that preceded them. I know that in the common discourse, blockchain and crypto assets are usually connected with all kinds of investments, speculation, and the such. That means that many people connect them to financial activities. But in the case of non-fungible tokens, this is rather questionable. In fact, even the term non-fungible was devised exactly in order to express that these kind of digital representations are different in the sense that they do not represent value, but something that that can be broken down on its unique characteristics. So the non-fungible brings the element of uniqueness. So if we put it now together, we have a digital representation of rights of a particular kind that have some level of uniqueness, and they can be assigned in different users of the ecosystem. This is how I would roughly describe it.
Perfect. No, it makes complete sense. So cryptocurrencies would be fungible. So you can, various, all the same.
Exactly. In that sense, the difference would be that, a cryptocurrency by its nature represents value, and it represents a certain amount of value. In that sense, it is not important whether you hold this or the other Bitcoin. At the end of the day, all you care about is the value. Whereby in the case of non-fungible tokens, you're more interested in the particular rights that they represent. And therefore, they differ. Also, of course, in terms of cryptocurrencies, and I think that is also an important difference that comes from the fact that non-fungible tokens are tokens. They are predominantly designed in order to be used within the blockchain. Mm-hmm. that they were created, whereby cryptocurrencies can also be used outside of blockchain ecosystems. They have already entered the so-called normal or physical transaction space.
That makes sense as an overview. And if you can maybe explain or give some use cases for NFTs.
The most hyped use case, I would say, is in the area of so-called digital collectibles. This is justified the term NFT being featuring in all kinds of news and general websites. Mm-hmm. So as we currently speak, people are interested in all kinds of digital assets that somehow try to emulate what collectible cards used to represent back in the physical world. But that is the interesting thing about non-fungible tokens. Because they are representations, digital representations of rights, they can, at the end of the day, be expanded in all kinds of other areas. Everything can be tokenized, but I say that with a bit of caution. When I say everything, I mean everything that entails rights and obligations, right? But indeed, NFTs can be used in order to tokenize all kinds of other assets, and I expect them very soon to start obtaining other use cases. There are all kinds of discussions currently where NFTs might go next. A profound example and use case is that of identity management. Many people are talking about creating all kinds of personal accounts, and instead of having access to them via a centralized database, having instead an NFT, mm-hmm. which will reside in a decentralized ecosystem. But I expect them to be the blockchain application that will be more adequate for common consumption, I would say. Because many things that we do in our digital lives can't be expressed through NFTs.
No, I agree. And that is one area where there's a desperate need for a product to fit the market, especially because of regulation and on-chain verification. Indeed. So that actually would be a great use case if it does take off. And also, we've seen there's actually a lot of behind-the-scenes court action when it comes to NFTs. Yes. And we're seeing, some courts in some jurisdictions actually take certain stances. So just last month, a Singapore High Court ruled that an NFT is a form of property and that it has jurisdiction to hear blockchain disputes in spite of their decentralized nature. I'm just going to read out a couple of paragraphs from this article by News Today. And then after, if you could just sort of give your comments and feedback. So the Singapore High Court, has ruled that an NFT is a form of property and not merely information or code on the blockchain. It has also ruled that it has the jurisdiction to hear cases of dispute involving the blockchain despite its borderless and decentralized nature, and that a claim can be brought on a person whose identity is hidden behind a pseudonym. So the claimant in this case is Mr. Janesh Raikumar, a Singaporean who owned an NFT from the Bored Ape Yacht Club. He had used his NFT as collateral for a loan to borrow cryptocurrencies from a Twitter user with the handle of chefpierre.eth. So the Bored Ape Yacht Club, for those of you who do not know, is a set of 10,000 cartoon monkeys made by US-based company Yuga Labs. So there was a dispute in relation to this NFT used for a loan. Now, to protect the NFT, the Singapore High Court issued an injunction on May 13th. The judge said, where disputes may arise over digital assets cited in the borderless decentralized blockchain, the Singapore courts can take jurisdiction over such disputes. Obviously, this development in terms of case law was very significant because it could set certain precedents. What are your thoughts on sort of, you know, property, NFTs, the courts?
Yes. Thank you. Thank you for the question, Justine. Well, this is a semi-interesting development. And why do I say semi-interesting? First and foremost, the UK and Singapore have somehow established themselves as the NFT worldwide litigation centers. The majority of NFT-related disputes appear before either UK or Singapore courts. There are several explanations to that phenomenon, but it is an important observation on the outcome of these cases because both UK courts and Singapore courts will apply common law. And we need to be a little bit careful on how we react to such cases because many institutions of the common law might not translate into civil law or other legal jurisdictions in exactly the same way. And although that might appear technical and that might appear to be a detail, it's really at the center of the debate. And now when it comes to the case per se, this is a typical NFT litigation. Everybody knows in the market that NFTs, despite the uncertainty as to their exact technical and legal nature, that they come with some kind of value. And exactly because they come with some kind of value, they have become interesting targets for all kinds of malicious actors. And probably a little bit the irony of the whole phenomenon, because blockchains were supposed to make any intermediaries redundant, people still go to courts in order to protect themselves when a malicious actor disrupts their connection, their association with their NFTs. And what is typical, not only in this case, but in all cases, is that there is also a difficulty to find the identity of the perpetrators, which of course further perplexes things. When it comes to the legal outcome of this case, it shall come as no surprise that it has been classified as property under common law, because the notion of property in common law is a rather wide one. In fact, because I went through this decision in quite some detail, the Singaporean judge has classified it as a choice in action, which is a rather broad family of rights, which in common law they are classified as property, but in other jurisdictions they would have a completely different legal character. And why does that matter? Because in the common language, the idea of property is associated with some kind of exclusivity, some kind of power to prevent anybody else from being able to exercise the one or the other right. But chosen action under common law does not necessarily represent this kind, this cluster of rights. But on the other hand, it is a judicial recognition of the fact that NFTs do have value and that they do merit some kind of protection. Now, if I were to translate that into Maltese law, for example, because we're hosted in Malta, I highly doubt that they would be classified as property. But nonetheless, that doesn't mean that NFTs would be completely unprotected. We will still, of course, have to find the proper vehicle within the Maltese Civil Code. Mm-hmm. But the fact that courts have started recognizing that legal remedies are necessary for NFTs, it's probably a good starting point. We can debate about the legal nature of these remedies, but at the end of the day, we would all agree that they are necessary. And I think that's the most important takeaway. This is why I would not lay my focus so much on the fact that a court said that NFTs are property, because that might be a little bit misleading. But I would say that the key message is that a court said that legal remedies shall protect NFTs.
Yes. So do you not agree that NFTs are property within the definition of the law? Obviously, depending on the law, once
again. It really depends. It really depends on several factors. First and foremost, it depends on the NFT itself.
Yes.
Because NFTs come in all kinds of different sizes and shapes, right? Now, if we talk about NFTs, which will allow users to control a digital asset, I would say that a property right might be an appropriate vehicle. But before coming to that point, there are several obstacles that we will have to overcome. I don't think that this is going to be an easy development. Why? Because we need to look at our existing laws. And when I say at our existing laws, my expertise lies with EU law. And that's what I feel comfortable talking about. And I can confirm that in EU law, the concept of owning something that is non-material, something that is digital, is something that the EU legislator and the Court of Justice of the European Union do not see rather positively. I would say on the contrary.
Okay.
If we see secondary EU law in the area of consumer protection, as well as CJEU case law from consumer / copyright protection, we will notice that in the mind of the EU legislator and in the mind of EU judges, digital assets can be accessed. They can be enjoyed at the superficial level, but they cannot be controlled by users. That represents the internet as we know it today, but unfortunately does not necessarily represent the aspirations of people that invest in NFTs. Why? Because the basic promise and the beauty of NFTs at the same time is that they are supposed to allow average internet users to exert control over their digital assets. And we will need to fight the good fight of convincing the EU legislator and the EU judges that Web 3.0 and blockchain are a different animal. Yes. And we shall not approach them under the lens, under the institutions of Web 2.0.
Yes, I agree. I mean, the traditional laws we have in place do not cater for, you know, Web3 and cryptocurrencies. And that's why we're seeing all these amendments and all these new laws, you know, come up and be drafted and built in various jurisdictions. And there's a lot of contrast as well, depending on where you operate, which takes away from the global nature of these assets as well. But that's another issue. You mentioned a lot, you know, common law and civil law. Can you just give a very brief, distinct definition or some contrasting aspects of common law and civil law?
Well, I would say that they present the two completely different traditions within the European cluster of legal families. I would say that common law is something that is predominantly applied in the UK and the former colonies, right? Malta is not one of them, by the way. Malta is an interesting case of a hybrid legal system with some elements of common law, but mostly, especially after the accession of Malta in the European Union, mostly continental European law. I would say that the basic difference of these legal families, common law and civil law, it's mostly on the approach. Common law is something organic. It develops through the precedent and the case law of the courts, which means that it is a little bit more spontaneous. The creation of general conclusions and abstract principles becomes a little bit more blurred and difficult. But at the same time, it's more adaptable. This is probably why these jurisdictions appear to be more friendly for something like NFTs, which is completely new. On the other hand, civil law jurisdictions are characterized by codification. There will always going to be a civil code, a commercial code, a criminal code, because these legal systems apply in abstract principles that have been derived by past experience. But that also makes them less flexible. It means that for something to change, we usually need legislative intervention, or let me put it in other words, judges in civil law countries are less prone to experiment with novel concepts. I don't want to be unfair to them. Of course, they can dare. And to be honest, exactly because I am a legal academic in that area, I would encourage them to do so. In fact, at this stage, apart from certain conditions, I would say that we shall not necessarily come to legislative changes. We shall encourage our judges to not be afraid of blockchain.
Right? I agree. Well, it is a technical, scary animal, and if you don't have any tech background, it's even, you know, bigger or more complex.
Yes.
However, thanks for that breakdown of common law and civil law. I think it's important to sort of understand why in certain countries there is a precedent or certain court cases are more influential, because they do set the tone for future similar disputes.
Exactly.
Whereas in other countries, they could be influential, but not as authoritative.
Exactly.
And since we're on the spectrum, you mentioned EU law.
Yes.
Which brings me to my next question. So you recently wrote an article titled On Arrogance and Drunkenness, a Primer on International Jurisdiction and the Blockchain. By the way, love the title of this Thank piece. It was really, really, really great. So you sort of centered your discussions around various questions, including shall blockchain-related disputes only be adjudicated before blockchain-based arbitrators, or is there still room for state courts? What state courts are involved in blockchain litigation? What kind of challenges will they face? How can Brussels regulation accommodate consumer or contract-related disputes? And finally, what courts would have jurisdiction to deal with NFT hacks or violations? So obviously, I mentioned quite a broad spectrum of questions, but could you shed some light on some of your thoughts and answers in relation to these questions?
Yes, again, thank you very much. Indeed, these are many questions. It took me 47 pages to explore them in the paper, and I assume our time does not allow to go through the entire piece, so I will really try to summarize what my main issue was when I was preparing this paper. First of all, on the title, I named it On Arrogance and Drunkenness. It is not my term. I have borrowed that from a Greek poet who wrote a poem about Darius, the ancient Persian king, and one unknown poet who was in the vicinity of the king and was thinking how to write a poem that will please the king so that I will make it in the inner circle. And arrogance and drunkenness goes to the fact that whenever we have centralized power structures, especially when they are controlled by human agents, the human agents tend to be corrupted by their own power. This is when they display arrogance and drunkenness. They are drunken in their own arrogance, and which also explains why blockchain ecosystems became necessary, I would say. But this is an important point because there is another story here which might lead to the same outcome, but from a different route. I have noticed that in legal literature, the majority of the colleagues that have dealt with the problem of dispute resolution, how to resolve problems if something goes wrong on the blockchain, because let us be honest, Satoshi Nakamoto thought that he has predicted everything, that everything is perfect in the system, that everything will be fine. But the reality is far from that. We know now, we have enough experience to say that no, things can go wrong in the blockchain. And I noticed that the majority of colleagues kind of think that blockchain ecosystems are self-sufficient enough to resolve these disputes on their own. And while I do not question the value of blockchain-based dispute resolution, I have the feeling that at the end of the day, access to state courts is still important and necessary for all kinds of reasons. Let me give you an example. We talked about NFT disputes. Isn't it amazing that all these people whose NFTs have been hacked, they have never addressed the blockchain arbitrator. They went straight to state courts. That probably showcases something. That showcases that the users, no matter how fascinated they might be by the technology, they know that at the end of the day, the guarantees of their basic rights are to be found before state courts. Not exclusively.
Agreed.
I understand that. Blockchain arbitration can do fantastic things. But NFTs, because they are something more personal than other crypto assets,
Agreed.
Display that people feel the necessity of addressing state courts. And having that in mind, because NFT litigation is by definition international, it is to be expected that people will be in all kinds of different countries and the involved stakeholders will be from all kinds of different countries. I wanted to have an academic exercise. I would like to test whether EU law provides for clear rules so that NFT users from Europe will know at any given point whether they can go to a particular court. And if we want to be honest, if I am an NFT user in Malta, I definitely want to go to Maltese courts. I don't want to leave my native jurisdiction. So this paper is about this academic exercise in order to see whether our European laws can guarantee that, an easy access to court. And my general conclusion is that in the majority of cases, that will be the case. Quite remarkably, these laws are based on ideas that were developed in the 19th century. And the 19th century is long before NFTs and all the problems that come with them. I would say that they are not fundamentally tested by blockchain. They can still be applied. Their application is not going to be easy or is not going to be always perfect. But hey, this is why the University of Malta hired me, right? That's, I'm supposed to help a little bit here.
No, I agree. And if we had to, thanks for that. If we had to break down even further, so we mentioned Brussels 1. So Brussels 1 is an EU directive which focuses on jurisdiction, enforcement of judgments.
Yes.
So based on Brussels 1, if I had to give you a scenario that, for example, there was a marketplace in the US and we have an EU-based user or acquirer of an NFT and there was a dispute. In this case, what would happen if the marketplace wanted to sue the EU user and the EU user wanted to sue the marketplace?
Yes.
So two scenarios. In the absence of a jurisdiction clause, because of course, if you have a jurisdiction clause, then that would govern.
Yes.
And in the absence of the relevant regulations. So in this case, based on Brussels 1, what would be the determination?
Thank you, Justine. Yeah, it's nice to make it concrete. Indeed, the Brussels 1A is a regulation, a European regulation, that wants to make sure that European citizens have a clear answer when they pose the question, I have an international problem, where shall I go to court? Can I go to my country? Shall I go to another country? And so forth. If we use the scenario now that you mentioned, we have an NFT marketplace and an NFT buyer, let us say from Malta, right, since we are in Malta. In order to apply the Brussels 1A regulation, there is a very necessary precondition. The defendant, that is the person against whom we bring an action, needs to be established, located, legally, so to speak, domiciled or registered in an EU member state. Now, as far as I follow the market, I know that the majority of NFT marketplaces are located in the United States, at least from very superficial research I have done. In that case, we need to ask the question, okay, we have a European buyer of an NFT and we have a marketplace in the United States. If the user wants to sue the marketplace is established in the United States. Can we apply the Brussels 1A regulation? Yes and no. What do I mean? If the user would be classified as a consumer, consumers can always sue at home under European law.
Yes.
It means that if we somehow convince a court that the Maltese buyer of an NFT is a consumer, this person will be able to seek redress at the courts of Malta. Mm-hmm. At least we will spare them the drama of having to send them to the United States.
Yes.
And I know that our courts in southern Mediterranean countries have a tendency to be slow, but at least they are cheap. On the contrary, if you have to go to the United States, you'll probably have to sell all your NFT portfolio in order to be able to afford the litigation.
Definitely.
There. So it comes with a strong advantage. In my opinion, in the majority of cases, there is going to be a good arguable case that an NFT buyer is a consumer, in which case they will be in a position to sue marketplaces within the European Union. There is a different question there, whether the NFT platforms are obliged to appear before European courts and whether we will be able to enforce and execute the cases.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that there are good chances for that to happen as well. Now, if we take the opposite scenario, what if the marketplace wants to sue the NFT user because the user, for example, didn't pay money, right? They purchased the NFT, but they have never done their deed. They have never sent the necessary amount of cryptocurrency, which can happen, by the way. It happened already, actually. In this case, there is a strong dilemma. Shall the marketplace come to Europe, Malta in our example? Well, the answer under the Brussels 1A regulation is absolutely yes. A consumer can only be sued at the domicile, at their domicile, at the courts of their domicile. What is problematic with NFTs, and I have explored that in this paper and I will further explore it, is that many NFT marketplaces have arbitration clauses. Arbitration clauses, just to break it down a little bit, are agreements between the parties that if something goes wrong, we will not go to state courts, but to an arbitrator, which is an alternative dispute resolution method. Traditionally, the Court of Justice of the European Union has been upholding these agreements, even when they include consumers. Unfortunately, I would say. Why? Because if you look at the terms and conditions of all NFT marketplaces, they all have an arbitration clause. And what is most important, we cannot negotiate them. It's take it or leave it. They say if you want to be, they say that if you want to be in the platform, you need to accept this. In fact, many people don't even know that such clauses exist. I know that out of a professional fetish, that I have the tendency to go around and look at terms and conditions. But there is a major gap here in the protection of European consumers, which is something that I believe that the Court of Justice will need to close at some point. I think that there needs to be an agreement that consumers shall never be deprived of protection before their native state courts, because that is their natural protector. I have nothing against arbitration, right? But at the end of the day, the application of the EU consumer law acquis shall not depend on the will of the parties. Because if that were the case, then if somebody wants to avoid EU consumer law, all they have to do is to include an arbitration clause in their contracts.
Exactly. And as you said, no one really reads these terms and conditions and disagreements, which is a part of the problem, of course.
Yes.
Definitely hard to address, you know. But, I mean, we'll see. I doubt that they will insert such a clause, in my opinion. But that would definitely solve the issue of giving consumers their basic rights in terms of addressing state courts. So in your opinion, just to sort of summarize, if an NFT qualifies as a utility token and not a security or something like that, a utility NFT, it could be protected under traditional laws if it qualifies, if the user qualifies under consumer.
Absolutely. I think that there is a strong consumer element there. I mean, there is always a debate whether NFTs are investment vehicles or not. And we can have that debate, of course, but if we set that aside for a second and we accept that at least some NFTs are not necessarily investments, then they do have a strong consumer undertone. Why? Well, because let us face it, we usually buy NFTs for fun, for social status. And these are activities that are outside of our trade or profession. We don't buy NFTs in order to be... For example, if we take you don't buy NFTs in order to be able to offer legal services.
Not yet.
Right? Not yet, right? Unless a use case develops. But as we currently speak, NFTs have a strong consumer undertone, and I think that they fit nicely in that regard within the consumer law acquis. Now, whether they will amount to property or not, that we will have to see, but it's something that I would not take out of the table in the preamble. It's just something that we will have to fight a little bit more.
Okay, no, and I completely agree. And if we had to go one step further from, okay, you know, we have the jurisdiction issues depending on where the party is, what relevant regulations apply, is there a jurisdiction clause, is it limited to arbitration? Let's say that there has been a court case which is in the UK. So here I'm getting at, in recent news, specifically in July 2022, a UK court judge served legal documents via an NFT. So we're speaking about the service of documents. In June 2022, so quite recently, also a law firm in the US served a defendant using an NFT in an 8 million hack case. So do you agree with serving such documents in this way, so i.e. via NFTs? And what are some of the potential problems which you could see arise from such form of notification?
Yes, we were talking in the beginning of our discussion about use cases. That is an interesting use case, right? Bringing NFTs into the judicial area, who would have thought that judicial area is usually, or litigation is considered to be something boring, not associated with something cool like NFTs, but yeah, there we have it. And apart from a very interesting use case, it also makes for a fascinating legal problem here. Why? Again, the fact that these cases were mostly decided by UK courts, again, make a difference.
Yes.
Now, to break it down a bit, when we talk about service of documents, it appears something technical, but at the end of the day, it's not at all. It is the most substantial guarantee for the protection of our right to be heard by a court. And I can understand the judges in the UK that up to a certain extent they accept it. The service, why? Because, as I said earlier, in the majority of NFT cases, we have the inherent problem of not knowing the identity of the perpetrator. And one of the reasons that pushed the UK and US courts, for what matters, to accept this kind of service of documents was because otherwise it would be impossible for the plaintiff to start the proceedings. It is just to break it down, mm-hmm. it is an absolutely necessary precondition for a trial to start that the defendant has been served with the documents. But here is now again where the particularities of common law of the UK legal system come into place. Because if I were to translate these cases into European law, I would have to refer to another regulation, the regulation for the service of documents. And according to EU law, proceedings can only start if it is somehow proven and guaranteed that the defendant has actually received the documents.
Yes.
And this is where my problems with this decision mm-hmm. start. Mm-hmm. Why?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you serve legal documents, if you serve them via an airdrop on the wallet of somebody, how certain it is that somebody will indeed have access to this document? And I would say that there is 0% guarantee.
Agreed.
To give a simple example, within the same wallet, somebody might have 20 different public keys. In which of them are we supposed to serve the NFT? And which makes sure, is there any element that makes sure that it is going to be the public key that they will indeed look at when they will open up their wallet? I myself have two different public keys randomly. I did that without even realizing that I did so. So I already have a problem recognizing that I have two yes. different public keys. And then only recently I realized that the transactions that I have with the one and the other key are different, that they're not related to one another. And since I am the average user, I think that many people would have the similar problem. Of course, you're going to say, okay, a hacker is not an average user. If they are able to hack NFTs, they are of course good enough in order to be able to know that. But exactly because they're a hacker, the chances that they move around this wallet are minimal because they need to be careful. Otherwise, they will be identified. So although what hackers do is, of course, questionable, I would say that service of documents via NFTs is a very attractive premise, but I would be afraid to generalize these decisions. I would say that these are decisions that are taken within a very specific context in order to address a very specific problem in a very UK-specific manner. And I find it difficult to see how they would be transferred into EU. But that does not mean, on the other hand, that it would not be attractive to think of NFTs as an electronic service method. Why? Mm-hmm. Because the service regulation that I just mentioned, it has been revamped last year. It provides for electronic service of documents. And it does not specify what this electronic service might be. It leaves it up to the member states. Why not? Why not using NFTs? But using NFTs in a way that will technically and legally guarantee mm-hmm. that when we serve documents with NFTs, then the defendant, there is a guarantee that the defendant has access to the judicial documents.
Agreed. In fact, here in Malta, you can only do so if you have positive notification. So in actually the civil registry, there's a stamp at the back. You know, it can be a messenger, it could be email, it is whatever it is, but proof that the documents have yes. been received. Because otherwise, how can one defend themselves? And, you know, the court case in absentia is not really justice.
Yes.
So it's a very dangerous precedent to set.
Yeah.
And I agree, I don't think in Malta or Europe will handle the same way.
Yes.
And hopefully the UK perhaps will change its precedent once realizing certain dangers or challenges from the missing notification
yes.
element.
With all due respect to the British judges, who are of high quality undeniably, I think that they didn't properly understood the
yes.
technical part of the case.
Mm-hmm.
This is why they were not able to measure whether the defendant would indeed see the documents.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I understand a judge who is presented with such a pressing issue. You have a person in front of me that is telling you, I have invested 200,000, for
yes.
example, on this NFT, and now it's lost. Give me something.
Yes.
That might have played the role as well, because as I said, the inability to identify the perpetrator leads to the problem of not being able to commence legal proceedings at all, and that
Definitely.
Has happened in Europe. There was Definitely. An infamous internet-related case It's the Cornelius Visser case from the Court of Justice of the European Union, where a person whose personal data have been made available by somebody online, they have never been able to identify that somebody. And therefore, they had an objective problem of getting that down. Mm-hmm. So it can be really problematic.
Definitely.
Therefore, I understand why a court might be tempted in such extreme circumstances to go for such a solution.
Must have had a very good lawyer. I mean, it's the only way.
or at least a lawyer who was willing to experiment enough.
Yes. Yes, yes.
And
yes.
Would charge, of course, equal though fees, right? We have to be also honest with that.
Now we've been speaking about European regulation a lot and how we deal with things here in Europe. So if any of you are in the legal service and are listening to us, you have definitely heard of MiCAR, which is a crypto asset regulation, which the final text of which has been published and the European Parliament will come to vote on very, very soon. Now, from your interpretation of MiCAR, which I'm sure you've been through since you are such an academic and a lover of this space,
not necessarily guarantee, though, that I would be an expert on MiCAR, right?
We can't pretend. So does MiCAR regulate NFTs or mention NFTs throughout the document?
Yeah. I want to be straight on that. MiCAR does not regulate NFTs. And if I might add, for the better. Mm-hmm. Why? Because MiCAR is an ecosystem regulation. What do I mean by that? MiCAR wants to create a safe ecosystem in general. It doesn't care so much, it does not care only about regulating certain products. It cares about regulating a market. What MiCAR mostly wants to achieve is transparency in a market which exists. It's very vibrant, but right now, moves under shady terms. I don't want to mention the names Luna or FTX, but I think we all have witnessed what happens when stakeholders are allowed to go around without any transparency guarantees. That was the primary target of MiCAR. And therefore, I think it was better that NFTs were left out. But NFTs will be regulated. Yeah. I think that is an important message to impart. The fact that they did not make it into MiCAR does not necessarily mean that they will remain completely unregulated. In fact, I know that the European institutions, the Parliament, the Commission, are already working on subsequent legislation which will be tailored to NFTs. And I can already tell you that it is also an internal fight within the European Union. Will that be consumer protection? Will that be market and innovation? Why? Because depending on what priorities the European Commission and the European institution will set, that will decide on how flexible the regulation of NFTs is going to be.
That's it.
Of course, when I say flexible, I mean by European account, right? For American standards, this is already too much red taping, right?
I agree. In fact, you know, the EU Commission said we are leaving out DeFi and NFT, and we are fully aware of that because we want to address stable coins due to certain systematic risks. However, stay tuned. In 18 months from date of entry into force, we'll have MiCAR 2.0 dealing with DeFi and NFTs. So it will be interesting, definitely, to see how they are going to regulate the space and how everything will roll out.
And by the way, I think that what happened with Terra Luna and what happened with FTX is a good sign that the European Commission is on the right. Mm-hmm. The European Commission is right to believe that these areas need to be regulated because, again, I don't want to be classified as somebody who is against the market. I'm not. But I'm for a disciplined market, like a market that serves the benefits of us all. If we leave the market completely unregulated, if we fall for the fallacy that, blockchain and the market will somehow regulate everything themselves, I think that we are opening the door of some kind of anarcho-capitalist utopia, which we definitely wouldn't like to be at the end of the day.
I think slowly with each episode, people are realizing that we do need some regulation. definitely not over-regulation, but some regulation to validate and protect the market.
Exactly.
So this sort of, you know, extremist view of this utopian vision of, you know, DeFi and anarchist sort of views are slowly, you know, sort of being broken down, and people are realizing that we do need to protect the market.
I'm happy that you see it like that, because in academia I feel a bit lonely. I'm probably the only one who insists about that.
I myself have changed my views over the months and years, you know, due to all these events, which actually sort of speak for themselves. I recently, you know, I did something on LinkedIn. I posted something about the recent FTX event. And at the end, I quoted, anarchy is merely an illusion of freedom, because in actual fact, that is what it is. Now, I'd just like to close this session with a bit of a personal question. Do you yourself own any NFTs? And then what area or industry do you think we may see a boom in terms of use case leveraging tokenization of assets?
I would love to own NFTs, but I don't. And I want to make clear why. First and foremost, because I know way too much in order to invest right now. But I'm kidding.
I will send you one, you're honest.
Okay, okay. But in full honesty, I don't have it yet, because I think that NFTs suffer from a twofold immaturity. I think they are immature both in technical and in legal terms. And I don't accuse the market for that. Mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong. It is absolutely understandable that at this stage they are immature. Why? Because they developed spontaneously without any guidance. But my major concern about NFTs, especially the model where the NFT is stored off-chain, is the problem that anybody can download the NFT. So I see no reason to own something that it is perfectly replicable by somebody else. That is the problem with digital assets. Their copies are exactly identical. If I download now, and to be honest, I do that for the purposes of my teaching at the university, I'm not violating any copyright if somebody has the doubts. There is an educational exception that allows me to do that in order to demonstrate to my students. But the fact that I can create instantaneously an exact same digital copy of the asset for which somebody requires me to pay more than 70,000 euros is something that I would not do at this stage. Does that mean that NFTs will always be like that? No. I know for a fact that NFT business models are developing. In the very beginning, for example, the majority of NFT projects were using IPFS, decentralized servers, to put the underlying asset. More and more companies now are trying to store the NFTs on-chain. Mm-hmm. Storing the NFT on-chain is a form of guarantee that only the person that owns the certificate will be able to exert some kind of control. At the same time, you're telling me, okay, but if it is on the blockchain, somebody can screenshot it. Yes, but the NFTs can be stored on-chain in a way that makes screenshot impossible. Mm-hmm. So I believe that the market will develop enough for me to proudly say one day that I have purchased a digital asset over which I exert the quality of control that would allow me as a legal academic to demonstrate in a future paper why this might qualify as property.
Maybe then you will read the terms and conditions of the marketplace
always,
of the NFT.
Always.
And if something goes wrong, you yourself can definitely you know, organize where you're going to take the dispute and what the applicable laws.
Probably, yes.
All right, great. So that was a really interesting and valuable discussion. Before I let you go, I'd just like to go for a round of I Call Bullshit, which is the time where I'm going to read out a question to you and just tell me if you think it's true or false.
Okay,
so Reebok has made more many selling NFTs than any other brand in the world. So the sports giant reported a total of more than 67,000 NFT transactions worth $185 million, passing Dolce & Gabbana. So do you think this is true or false?
False.
Okay.
First, because it's Reebok.
Exactly.
I question the premise that Reebok is a sports giant.
Okay, who do you think it is?
There are two recognizable companies, which are Nike and Adidas.
It's they Nike.
Are, yes. Right. So definitely, I mean, I know that Nike has purchased Reebok, But I would highly doubt that they would use Reebok as the spearhead of their NFT operations.
It was Nike. But 185 million, I mean, that's quite impressive.
Well, that has to do with the fact, and that relates to the previous question, which I left partially unanswered. I believe that many people are preparing themselves for the metaverse in that case. Mm-hmm. Because there was a lot of hype in the previous months about Adidas or Nike-controlled metaverse spaces. And NFTs is a good way to be involved in that process somehow. I think probably that explains the hype. Now, in how far that will come to be, I don't know. But I do believe that the metaverse will emerge in one form or the other. And I do believe that the NFTs will be an integral part of it. Although such predictions, of course, always fail. But nonetheless, if I am to make a prediction, I would say that a genuinely digital environment where people will be able to interact and develop social relationships is probably a good premise for NFTs, probably.
And that's great. And I completely agree with you. On that note, Ioannis, thank you so much for being a guest on this great episode. For those of you listening, if you would like to contact Ioannis, you can find his LinkedIn and also in terms of the documents we've referred to during the episode, namely the research paper that Ioannis worked on. We will put this in the text box underneath the episode. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Justine, for the excellent discussion and the kind invitation.